And I'm excited to have this episode today here with Hadi Halabi. He was in investment banking. He had a very good, nice job, nice cushy salary as you get it in investment banking. And then, you know, he took the big risk of starting his own company in sports. Who doesn't love sports?
There's a lot going on in sports. And this is a truly restricted asset class where people don't really have any access.
What are some of the main challenges, right?
I'll talk about all the challenges, but the biggest one is that...
What would you say that are three traits, you know, to get into this entrepreneurship journey? What three traits do you need?
I think resilience, conviction, slash belief in yourself. It's the most important thing. And then... I would say the third one is...
So business is going well. Everything's going well with that new startup you're
it's
working
good.
On.
It's good. So far, so good.
Amazing.
Exciting stuff happening.
Amazing. And I'm excited to have this episode today here with Hadi Halabi. Hadi is one of my good friends, very good friends. It's a pleasure to have you, man.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here and to finally do this with you.
Habib, well, it's honestly due time. We had to do it.
Watching this podcast for a while. I've known you for a long time, but it's good to do this.
Yalla, we're almost gonna hit a decade of friendship.
That's true.
We're getting old, man. No, we're young.
We're growing younger.
100%. So today, guys, I have, as I mentioned, fabulous guest, and what we're gonna dive into is basically how Hadi, he's going to tell a bit more about himself, but he was in investment banking. He had a very good, nice job, nice cushy salary as you get it in investment banking. And then, you know, he took the big risk of starting his own company, and he's going to talk a bit more about it. It's called Stride. It's super interesting. It's in sports. Who doesn't love sports?
That's true.
So Hadi, maybe you can give a bit of a background, right, of what you did, you know, what you worked in and what's Stride, what are you doing at the moment, and then we'll start talking about how it all started.
Thanks for the intro. You covered pretty much everything, but yeah, to take you a bit of to take you back a bit, I finished university, came to Dubai and did corporate finance for a few years. During that time, I had an idea that private markets in general are very restricted. You and I have a lot of friends that want to invest in different types of assets, different types of opportunities, but they can't. We've seen a lot of startups or venture capital, mm-hmm. but we've also seen less and less IPOs in recent years, which means that if you want to buy and sell stocks, not everything is out there. Biggest examples are SpaceX, biggest examples are Stripe, which is still private, Revolut is still private. You've got top companies that are not publicly listed, so people cannot really buy and sell those companies. So my idea was, and that also came through the experience of working with private companies on, you know, mergers, acquisitions, capital raises, that there has to be a better way of doing things. There has to be a better way of making it accessible and making it simple and making it more attainable. And given that people in our world, and you know, we've seen that, love investing and they love exploring different types of investments and diversifying their portfolios, this was the main thesis behind it. So what is Stride today? Stride is a digital investment platform that allows people to invest in sports and entertainment. And essentially, we built an end-to-end digital solution where someone like you and me can go on a platform and access a global sports team in the US, let's say NBA, NFL, or in Europe, Premier League, La Liga, Liga, Serie A. But then also beyond that, Indian cricket, emerging leagues, paddle, tennis, and there's a lot going on in sports. And this is a truly restricted asset class where people don't really have any access. You've got a few clubs that are publicly traded, namely Man United, Juventus, Borussia Dortmund, but you don't really have anyone who's investing in sports, and we've treated it for so long as an entertainment, but now it's becoming a sustainable business, and we can talk a bit more about that in a bit. But the idea was, I wanted to democratize private markets. We came across sports and realized that sports is a good investment opportunity, and this is where there is true potential, and we fully pivoted into that. So today we became a digital sports and entertainment investment platform where anyone like you and me, where family offices, where funds, depending on the ticket size, it doesn't matter if you want to put 10K or 100K or a million, you can invest through the platform. We'll talk about more technicalities in a bit, but yeah, that's kind of the intro.
I mean, super fascinating, as you mentioned, and it's the first of its kind in the world, if I'm not mistaken, right? So Stride is basically giving access to, let's say, not ultra high net worth individuals, right? It's giving access to the general public to invest in clubs. I mean, from what I know right now, Benfica is a big Portuguese club that's available. Watford is a big English club where you that's not available. And this is really, you know, it's different from what's out there.
Yeah.
So, and people like to invest, I think, in different elements. We're all looking to diversify, right? Yeah. There's this other platform that really did well called Masterworks.
Yeah, of course.
So they gave access to art.
Yeah.
Because it was also only available to these ultra high net worth individuals, but they democratized it and made it available to the general public. Hadi, let's get a bit, you guys, you can see there's a lot we're going to cover. We're going to cover how it all started, how you developed the idea, how, you know, you pitched it to investors, how you raised funds, how you built the team. We're going to get into all of that. Let's get maybe start off with the beginning, right? You're in investment banking. Everyone knows investment banking, very cushy job, where... very good salary, amazing bonuses. So, you know, it's risky. At the end of the day, even though it's a fabulous idea, I love it, and it's first of its kind, first movers and everything, it's still risky. Everything's still risky. And you're giving up that big part, right? So how did you go about it, right? How did that decision, how was that decision made?
Investment banking is a great job. For anyone who wants to be in the corporate world, for me, it was a very nice job. It was a job that was difficult, long hours, challenging, but I enjoyed it. The problem was not with the job itself. The problem was with what I wanted. And for me to spend, you know, 10, 15 years climbing a corporate ladder is not where I saw myself, even if that job is paying well, or even if that job is, you know, top of the top. And I mean, if you want to compare it, you've got investment banking, and at least in our world of finance and business, investment banking, consulting, and lawyers, corporate lawyers. This is kind of the top jobs in corporate. And it's a good job, but if it's not aligned with where you want to go or where you want to be, then what's the point? You can stay and spend time there and make money and get promoted and reach level after level, and it's good, it's not bad, but this was not where my conviction was. This was not where I wanted to, you know, spend my career and put the effort in. I was working 18 hours a day sometimes, and I felt I can do that, and I didn't mind it, but why not do it for myself? And if I had an idea that I fully believe in, and if I had the faith in myself that I obviously had, then why not try and see what you can do on your own? You fail, but if you make it, you make it. Like, you're responsible. At least I cannot blame anyone, I cannot blame anything, I cannot say this culture does not fit me, I cannot say this was unfair or this was fair. It's all on you, which is, you know, it's personal preferences, and every character is different. But for me, I felt that this made a lot of sense, because I just wanted to see how far I can go or how much I can do. And I wanted to see this idea through. I had full faith and full belief that this is needed. And I had full faith that this is something that the market would want and would adapt to. And I thought that I can make it happen. Yeah. Now, the idea I had in my head when I quit is completely different to how the experience turned out to be.
Definitely.
I thought everything is going to be easier, which, trust me, it's not, and it wasn't, and it won't be. But it was that, okay, I've got this, I've got that sorted out, I think the rest is covered, let's take the step. And if I had known today what it would actually take, I don't think I would have made, I would have probably made the same decision, but I don't think I would have made it in the same ease or comfort, because it's much more difficult than I thought. I wouldn't change it, and I would do it a million times again, but it's not easy. And, you know, the safety net, the cushy job, the security, the stability is good. And I think as you grow older, you become more and more, less and less risk taker, and more and more risk averse.
Yeah.
So with age, that if I did that decision 5 years down the line, I think I would have probably not, because the decision was just conviction. I was like, I have nothing secured, nothing sort it out, but I think I can sort it out. Let's quit.
And you're young. I think you did it at a
26.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At a good age, right? Yeah. You did it at 26. So, and that's the age. It's better to try it now than, you know, go later on in your life and have those regret moments. Maybe I should have tried it. Because at the end of the day, whatever happens, and hopefully it will become a unicorn.
We're on the right track.
Inshallah. But it's like, you can definitely go back to corporate if that...
Look, I don't think about that because, I'm sure if something went wrong, I can find a million solutions for it. But that's not what I think of. I've got one thought process today, one goal, which is... go as big as I can, make this happen, and, you know, serve the market exactly how it should be served.
Amazing.
And that's the only plan.
And did people support you? Did people support you? Yeah, your surroundings, your family, your friends, right? Were they supportive of that decision of leaving your job and starting your own thing?
Yeah, I think my close friend, my close circle, my family were very supportive of that decision to try and do your own thing. And, you know, parents, you know how our parents are, right? Mm. They're scared. They want you to be in a safe place. They probably wouldn't want you to take as many risks. At least my parents, they wouldn't want you to take big risks that can, you know, end up in a very drastic situation. But if you phase that out properly, it's it works. But yeah, for my friends, my close circle, they were all very supportive. A lot of them ended up being investors in the business, and I think I'm blessed with the group that I have.
And you said that it's a very difficult journey, right? And I will get into all of these parts that we previously mentioned, but what are some of the main challenges, right? Because you're building something, right, on your own. You're building it from the ground. So do you have these moments where you feel like it's you against the world, for example, and you keep on pushing, you keep on pushing, you keep on trying? Do you feel these moments as, you know, these moments maybe of solitude? Is that maybe one of the challenges, or maybe there's another big challenge that you face?
I'll talk about all the challenges. But the biggest one is that you go through a lot of ups and downs, and sometimes on a daily basis. In the morning you go through ups, in the evening you go through downs, right? It's very tricky, and you have to have a lot of resilience, because it's easier to tap out sometimes than to keep going. But the challenges, if you want us to name them, it's literally across the spectrum. One is the right team and the right people that you surround yourself with, because it's a lonely journey. It is you against the world, and you have to believe that every single day. And I still do, and I think it'll be us against the world for the rest of the journey. But you need to surround yourself with people who have the same vision, people who can take a bit of the load off you, which is very challenging and very tricky, finding the right people. And the second bit is, we built a business that's a regulated business. We had to go through a journey that we knew nothing about, which is getting regulated and building a financial services business. And we had to work with the regulators, and we had to spend time, and we had to face setbacks working with lawyers, compliance individuals and compliance firms, back and forth, drafting compliance documents and policies and procedures. And, you know, the technical stuff, the technical aspect of these things was not straightforward at all. And then obviously there is building the right product and getting customer feedback and knowing that this would work, because we can build so many products and we can create so many things. There is zero guarantees anyone needs it or anyone will use it. And then the final challenge, final say title or headline, funding, right? Yeah. Business, any business, if it's not bootstrapped or generating revenues, it needs to be funded. And for a business like ours, we had to raise money before we launched, because we're regulated, because we had to spend money before we actually launched, we had to raise money. So if you don't raise money, which is extremely challenging, by the way, it's not easy. Raising capital is generally not easy. But if we didn't do it, we would have just been out of business. So you had to raise money, and you had to raise capital, and you have to, you know, keep growing and keep building that journey. And you have to make sure that those investors are getting their reporting from you, but then they can also see the growth that's going on, which thankfully, I mean, at many points we stagnated because we had to wait for this and that to happen. But for the past, I would say, 9 months, it's been a really, let's say, fascinating ride.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, there are all of these challenges, you and many other, right?
Yeah, many others.
These are the the headlines that you mentioned, and it's good to be aware of them, right?
Yep.
Beforehand, so you can prepare yourself mentally.
I actually think it's good to not be aware.
Not be aware.
I think the delusion sometimes is extremely important, and
yeah.
I fully believe in that. I think delusion is a must. You have to think that it's easier. You have to think that you've got it all covered, but then realize that you haven't. But then you're already in hell. So
yeah.
why would you stop? I mean, I thought it's easy, but it turned out it's not easy. I just have to keep going.
Keep going.
If you have that resilience, which is why resilience is the most important thing, you're going to keep going. You're going to figure it out.
Yeah.
Challenge after challenge. And trust me, we've probably faced hundreds of challenges.
Yeah.
And every day is a new challenge in one way or another.
Okay.
So resilience is number one. And I think delusion is...
Delusion
is important.
Delusion is important. So when you say delusion, it means, I know, believing in the idea so much that, or also thinking that it's going to be easier than
thinking that it will work out.
Okay.
You know, just being delusional that this will happen and that will happen. When I quit, I thought this is all going to be a piece of cake.
No.
In 6 months, we'll be up and running, we'll be killing it. It's not the case.
It takes a lot.
But if you knew what it takes and if you weren't delusional about it, it's much more extremely difficult to actually do it because it's tough.
What would you say are three traits, you know, to get into this entrepreneurship journey? What three traits do you need?
I think resilience, conviction / belief in yourself. It's the most important thing. And then I would say the third one is... That's an important one. Resilience, conviction, and ruthlessness.
Okay.
But I took my time with that because there's many options. But I think one thing I've learned is you have to set emotions aside and you have to be ruthless.
Yeah.
If something doesn't feel right or isn't working, cut it off. Something or someone or whatever it is. One thing we've done is we haven't been afraid of changing. We've pivoted, we've changed the name, we've done many, many changes, and we keep on changing, which is good. Do not have an emotional attachment to anything and be ruthless. With the product, with the idea, with the team, you have to be ruthless. So these are the three most important things in my opinion.
And on the other hand, what are three traits that you should not have? You think they would kill, you know, or they would kill the probability of someone being successful in entrepreneurship?
Tough questions. You obviously can't be lazy. You have to work your ass off 24/7, weekends, holidays. This does not exist. I mean, you can't. You have to outwork everyone else because there's someone else that can be quicker than you and do much better than you. So you can't be lazy. You can't be emotional, so that's the opposite of ruthlessness, because you can't be attached to an idea or a person or a thing. You have to be just free and you have to just cater to the feedback you get. We moved into sports, but the business was not a sports business, and we'll talk more about that. And the third one, laziness.
Not being emotional.
Not being emotional, so emotionless.
Yeah.
And the third one is... dependent.
Yeah, okay.
I think in this world you cannot depend on anyone. You have to know you're not on your own. You're surrounded by good people and you're surrounded by a good team. But you have to learn that everything has to be managed, controlled, overseen. No one will know your business as much as you do. And no one will care about your business as much as you do. It's your business after all. So you have to be independent and you cannot depend. And you can rely as you grow. But in the early stages, you cannot depend on others. You cannot depend on an outsourced talent. You cannot depend on an agency. You have to depend on yourself and you have to have you know, control over all of that in the early days.
Totally agreed. And everything you mentioned, I think... whoever's listening should and wants to start the journey should apply them. I would add one more thing to the list of traits, maybe discipline is something that is crucial.
Right? Absolutely,
you need to be disciplined in, you know, in how you want to get these advanced investors. You need to discipline yourself, reach out to that person, structure it in a way where you're following up at the right time, right? Because I know with investors might be a bit tricky, for example, not hassle them every day. And also you don't want to, when you go towards an investor, you don't want to seem desperate at that. And in any case, that's something that will hurt you. So be disciplined in your emotions, as you mentioned, because being emotional, and now we're going to get to your idea how it started, right? You were not emotional and you did not stick to the first name that you guys gave your company. You shifted. You didn't shift to the, it is still within the main concept, right? But you didn't shift to that. You didn't stick with that idea. You saw there's a niche that you can attract, which is sports. So maybe now you can tell us a bit more, you know, how the idea actually started and how you saw actually what the market was needing more and how you pivoted towards what it is right now, which is Stride.
Discipline, fully agreed, by the way. And I think it goes hand in hand with resilience, because a lot of those investors that you're reaching out to will say no. And a lot of people will say no. And you need to not take no for an answer. And you need to understand that 90-95% of people will not believe in what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And if they did, there's something wrong. But I'll give you a bit of a background on how it all came together. When I was living in London, I was studying, doing my master's there. I came across a platform, a European platform that allows people to invest in startups with £10, £50, £100, as much as you want. And I loved the idea. So I started putting £100 here and £100 there, and I enjoyed it. But even when I was not investing in those companies, I was just browsing the platform, seeing what's going on out there, the innovation. And then I moved to the region, and there was no similar product. So no one was doing that. And that concept of democratizing venture capital, I thought was great, and if it's working outside, why not replicate it here? And initially, I think the case studies in this market are all just replica of something out there, right? Kareem is an Uber, Souq is an Amazon, Tabby is a Klarna. It all started outside, and then we built our own products, which is completely fine. I think that's actually extremely smart. Something is working outside but does not exist in your market, build it in your market. So that was the idea. And we wanted to do venture capital, wanted to do startups, wanted Waleed and Hadi and everyone listening to be able to invest $500, $1,000, $10,000 into startups without going through the hassle of how do I get the deal, and is the deal good or bad, and how do I get the paperwork done. It's pretty complex. So I thought the market needs that. And we're surrounded by, you know, bankers, consultants, lawyers who have disposable income and who end up saving a significant part of it, which means that they would want to diversify their investments. Some people like me like risky investments, where venture capital, you can lose all your money, but then you can make 10x or 100x or 1000x. Where else can you make that? So I love venture capital. And I thought I want to build a digital platform where people can do that digitally, fully end-to-end, hassle-free. And that was the initial idea. And based on that, we started exploring a license, building a product, getting feedback, and it was good. So during that time, we pivoted. The first pivot was, instead of doing regional startups for regional investors, let's do global startups for regional investors, because we realized that there's a lot of opportunities outside that you really don't have access to. Waleed cannot invest in a Y Combinator-backed San Francisco startup, right? Mm. He can, but it's so difficult, and ticket size is high, and it's extremely inaccessible. So he can't, effectively. Mm. We wanted to do that, where Waleed can invest in companies that are also outside, in ventures that are also outside. That was the first pivot. And we got good feedback on that, and we managed to do some partnerships and work with venture partners that can source the deals for us. And we built a good network and some connections that got us those deals. And that was the initial launch. So after working for 18 months on getting regulated, we got the license, we launched the product with those startups. In the meantime, we're getting feedback for, you know, what works, what doesn't, some features to add, some features to remove, and what people were liking and not liking.
Can you say the name? Or you want to mention the name of what your startup was, right, before you changed it?
The name of the company?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was Sahem. Sahem. So we started as Sahem. The initial idea was Sahem. And why? It's because, you know, Sahem in Arabic is share or stock. And we thought, yeah, we're a local brand. Let's have an Arabic name. I'll tell you why we changed it in a bit. Mm. But we got those companies, the global companies, listed them on a platform, and we launched with that. One of them was a Y Combinator-backed biotech company in London, and the other one was a California-based gaming company that was backed by top VCs. And then we also had a Germany-based climate tech business that had partnerships with Formula One, for example. So it was interesting. But then from one conversation to another, we got access to a sports deal, and that sports deal was Watford. We put Watford on the platform, and the traffic, the engagement, everything that happened in terms of awareness was incredible. Football, English football team on a platform where people can invest and own shares in an English football team, that was revolutionary. We've never seen that in the region. We've also barely ever seen that in the world anyway, but it was revolutionary. You know, I'm a big sports fan. Sure. And I started digging deeper into the business side of sports, which as a concept is relatively new. And I thought it makes a lot of sense. There is a lot of opportunities in sports. Now, before we get into sports, we wanted to change the name because we went to a lot of conferences and events where non-Arabic speakers were introducing us on stage, talking about the company and saying Saham, Sahom, Sahim, Sahim, Sahim. Even the Arabic speakers were confused between Sahim and Sahim. So it's pretty confusing. And I thought we had to change the name. So we spent 2-3 weeks quickly checking names, coming up with names, and maybe 300 names that we came up with. And we had to find the domain that still exists, .com or something else. And then Stride was the best fit. It's a name that makes sense. It's a word that means taking strides towards something higher. So it fits whatever model you want to do. So we changed to Stride with a Y.
Yeah.
And the domain ended up being gostride.com.
Nice.
It's pretty good.
It's pretty it is good.
In my opinion.
Yeah, for sure.
But then after that, the sports, to keep going on the sports story, we got Watford. I started digging deeper. I realized there's so much going on in sports. There's a lot of transactions. There's a lot of shares being bought and sold. But then there is also sophistication coming into sports, which is private equity firms are investing in sports, whether it's CVC or Sixth Street or specific sports private equity funds that are like Redbird, who own AC Milan, or Arctos, who have investments in Liverpool, Warriors, all across the NBA and MLB and NFL and European football. You've got Avenue Capital, you've got Ultra, which have investments in Formula One. It's like there's a lot going on. More than $100 billion has been raised for sports investments over the past years, a few years. And it made me think there's something changing. The space that we watch and we're entertained by, no one ever thought of it as a sustainable business. You know, someone who's wealthy will buy a club, burn cash. It's a trophy asset. I want to own a club and I want to be the owner of, you know, an X club or Y club. And I don't want to build it in a sustainable way. I don't care if it burns $20 million a year or if it burns $50 million a year. So now it's changing. Teams are becoming profitable. Yeah. Businesses are making money. The Brighton model, for example.
Yeah.
They're relying more on data and digitization and analytics. And there is so much going on where Brighton don't have any scouts. It's all digital. It's all tools where they scout the best players, get someone from Ecuador like Moises Caicedo and sell them to Chelsea for $100 million.
Wow. Yeah.
That's the new model. Nice. Right, there is more European competitions, there is more spots in those competitions, there is more media rights, it's more expensive, they're paying more money. There's a lot going on, and this was driven by, you know, institutionalization of those investments. And I thought, big space.
A huge space.
And you mentioned that it's only open for individuals, but even family offices and funds don't know how to activate that space or invest in that space, especially in our region. So we then realized we can be, you know, a sports fund, but fully digital. We can be the first global digital sports fund where anyone in the world can come onto the platform and invest in any of the deals that we have. And the minimum ticket can be as low as $1,000, which means a family office can come and put $1 million. A fund can come and put $5 million, but then Waleed and Hadi can come and put 10,000 or 20,000 or 50,000. And that's what we've been seeing. Mm. So we built that platform today to be the first global platform where anyone in the world can invest in sports and entertainment through Stride. Now, if we want to get more technical, access is pain point number one. We allow people and investors to access those types of deals. Pain point number two is how do you liquidate? This is not stock market. If I buy, I can't sell my shares. So how do I make money on the platform? there's many ways, but as a regulated business, we're allowed to have our own liquidity windows, our own basically secondary markets where Waleed, who bought shares, can sell it and someone else can come and buy those shares at the updated valuation. The other way you can make money is obviously if the shares grow in value and then the club is sold again, you're exiting as any of the other investors. So just like a venture capital investment where you invest in a startup, but you can only return your capital once someone else buys the company or the company IPOs or someone buys your shares. But the aspect of having a digital secondary markets is unheard of. And the problem with sports, it's been illiquid for so long. And now you can have liquidity on a digital platform. So that's pain point number two.
Yeah, man, beautiful stuff. You touched upon so many things, how you evolved. And the most important thing, one of the takeaways from what you just said, is adaptability, yeah. Right? You adapted to what the market mostly needs. Your initial concept was good. And more importantly, you also tackled a niche, right? You focused on a niche, which I think is very important to start off any business. You're focusing on sports right now. One of the things that's also fascinating is how you got Watford, right? How you're able to, hey guys, I want to take a part of your company, put it on my website and people can invest. How did you convince Benfica as well? Yeah. These are...
Wait until I tell you who's coming next on the platform.
Okay, yeah, you have to tell it exclusive to higher.
Not that I will disclose names yet.
Okay.
But we're getting the second largest cricket league in the world.
Nice.
To be on the platform.
Cricket team, yeah?
Yeah, league. So you can invest in the league, which is normally, investing in IPs is extremely interesting. And the franchises pay fees to those leagues, right?
Definitely.
It's an interesting one. It's coming out soon. We've got the Premier League team that we're working on. We've got an NBA team that we're working on. There's a Formula One allocation that I'm trying to work on. So these are all now happening. We have other exciting types of investments, like lower league football in England, similar to Wrexham and the Ryan Reynolds investment, in that same division where they were. And then we've got the paddle business in the US, which is a really interesting business. But there's so much going on. We're working on all of those deals now.
And how are you reaching these people? How are you networking, finding the connection, right? Is it cold outreach? Is it network as well? Or it's a mix of multiple things?
It's a great question. And that's how we source our deals. We realized that sports is a niche, as you mentioned. It's a $1 trillion niche, in my opinion. It's an insane market, but it's also a small ecosystem. Where you get to meet someone, you get to meet someone else, you grow the network, and then suddenly everyone in sports get to know each other and everyone knows Stride. So we built really good connections and good relationships with top private equity funds that I mentioned previously. We built good relationships with top VC funds in sports. We built relationships with deal makers, advisors, bankers, lawyers in the ecosystem. And now they're all kind of plugged into that Stride ecosystem in one way or another, where they're sharing deals with us, they want us to co-invest with them. They're coming in and, they're pitching us certain types of investments. And that's how we're getting very good deal flow and inbound and access to different deals.
Beautiful, man. Beautiful. So network. And since you mentioned that, right, it's important to have that right character, personality, since you're saying it's a lot of networking, right? You have to know how to communicate the right messages with the right people, especially people that have maybe limited time to actually, give you, right? They don't have that all day. So sometimes you have 5 minutes, sometimes you have 10 minutes to leave an impression. What's the best way to leave a good impression, for these people? And you're saying, it's networking. So one person to the other. So what's the most important thing, to make a good first impression?
The first thing you need to show is what value are bringing to the table. And as quick as possible, as simple as possible. What are we bringing to the table? One, we're bringing capital. Two, this capital is coming from a strategic region like the Middle East. Three, we're doing it in a digital way that can be much quicker than anyone else. So if we're telling someone that we can come and take a $5 million allocation, for a fund to do that $5 million allocation, it might take them 12 months. For us, it's as quick as, let's look at the deal. List the deal on our platform, get our investors in on those deals, set up the vehicle, close the deal. So it can be, in many cases, it can be 4 to 6 weeks, which is much quicker. So when you show that you're bringing in the capital, which is strategic and quick enough, this is the value that anyone in the world would want to speak to you about.
Beautiful. Very good stuff, man. If we want to go back a bit, just rewind, the initial investors, right, these people, you need to raise funds. You built a pitch deck, right? So how do you prepare for that? What do you need to do to attract investors, to reach investors and convince them to invest in your idea?
This is one of the most important points for any early stage company. I think the way that you can get access to at least get into the room is if people know you, if people trust you, if people believe in you. And if that's your direct network or, you know, your indirect network, someone is introducing to someone else and there's credibility, it's much better. And this is the way to go. When you can combine that with a great idea and a great prototype, demo, product, something that you can showcase, this is the winning formula. So if you go to the people that you know and you show them that you're onto something, then those people will actually come in and invest in your idea. And that's what happened with us. We raised money when we only had a pitch deck and, you know, a prototype of what we wanted to do. We had no license, we had no live product, we had nothing. All we had is a pitch deck that highlights what we wanted to do and who's the team behind it. People believed in that team, people believed in that vision, and they ended up investing. Mm. And we raised $700,000 off of that, which is relatively on the high end of, you know, pre-seed, pre-idea, pre-product, not pre-idea, post-idea, pre-product fundraising in the region. Mm. And people believed in us and the idea.
Oh, super interesting, right? So you raised $700,000. That's quite a significant number, right? And what comes with that is valuing your company, which yeah. a lot of people get, you know, a bit confused with that. Yeah. How do we do that, especially for a startup that's pre-seed revenue, correct? So how do you usually put that valuation, and how does it differ from one industry to another? I know people who put $2 million to start off with on a startup, another company that put $7 million, another that put $10 million, and most of these, all of the ones that I mentioned, are pre-revenue, yeah. right? So how does that work? How do you value it?
It's more art than science. Mm. When you have no revenue, no revenues, no EBITDA, no net income, you can apply no multiples, and the projections are fugazis. I mean, who knows if you're going to make $10 million in revenues in 5 years or $100 million, right? So it's a combination of multiple things. First of all, the world of venture capital has matured a bit. So now there is something called a safe note, which Y Combinator introduced, which is a very founder-friendly term sheet. And that safe note is simply commit an amount. It's a convertible note where that amount is the promise of equity down the line. And it's based on two things. One is a cap on the valuation. So you set a number, but that's a cap. And then the second thing is a discount. And the way it works is, let's say you select a cap of 5 million, and we'll talk a bit about how you get to that 5 million. And there's a 20% discount, which means that if I invest $1 million, depending on the valuation of the next round, which is when you should have matured a bit and had some revenues and it can be valued, you know, more science than art, that will determine the valuation of my round. If it's valued at 20 million, my cap is 5. So my million is coming at a 5 million. So I'm getting 20% of the business. If it gets valued at 3 million, which is lower than my cap, the 20% discount applies. So 20% on the 3 million is basically 2.4 million. So I'm coming in at a 2.4 million valuation. So now that 5 million, in my opinion, is industry benchmarks. And you have to know where you are, who's a comparable transaction, and how you can plug in those numbers. If I'm in fintech in the region, it's widely known that, you know, a pre-seed fintech can be valued between 4 and 8 million. If I'm in AI and I'm building in San Francisco, I can raise pre-seed money at a 50 million valuation, right? It's insane. You can raise, some of them can do $1 billion valuation pre-seed.
Pre-seed, unicorn pre-seed, yeah.
If I'm in food and beverages, F&B, where tech is not as important and it's not as scalable and it's not, the multiples will be applied differently, more of a traditional business with tech enablement, the multiples will be on the lower end and the valuation probably will be somewhere between 2 and 4 million in a pre-seed round. So depending on the industry, and there is a lot of information out there today, so whether it's Carta globally or whether it's, you know, local sources like Magnet, you can get a lot of data and you can, you know, plug that in and makes it, it makes it fair and it makes it more scientific, but it's really not. So that's the best way to get the evaluation in the early stages.
Benchmarking, very good exercise to do. And I think it allows also investors to see, okay, this guy or that girl, obviously, they did their due diligence. They're seeing what's in the market, what works, what, and that would give a fair evaluation. Yeah. And also, I think what you're offering, the idea itself, right? Like your idea was a first mover. It's different. It's unique. That also helps with the valuation. The team, right? Yeah. And the experience of that team, right? So there's you who has a very good background in investment banking. And there's also your co-founder, right? Yeah. Who has his background is in product development, right? Tech. Yep. So all of that, and your product is tech, what you're offering is tech, so having that person also, so all of this, I think it contributes right to this valuation. So Hadi, you built the deck, you got the investors, you got the cash. What did you do with that first round? What's the first thing you do? What's the first thing you build?
As in how we spend the money?
Yeah.
Legal fees and licensing fees were expensive for us. Getting regulated in Dubai in the FSA is again not straightforward. It's pretty difficult, as it should be, and I think it's you know, it's a barrier to entry now. But it's expensive to get regulated. You need to work with lawyers and compliance firms, and you know, you need to incorporate different entities, and you need to pay fees for the application and for the license itself. So it's not cheap. The second thing is we hired a few key individuals, and you know, salaries is an important part of where you spend. So that's been the kind of the biggest chunks of where it went. It was salaries, and it was mostly legal fees. But then also you have to do some business development, conference here, conference there, meeting this person and meeting that person and building relationships and being present and being visible. So that's also, you know, something that costs capital. We also spent on tech, obviously. You want to build the product, you have to build the right product, get the right tech tools, subscriptions, which trust me end up being much more expensive, you know, having the ChatGPT for the team, having Slack for the team, stuff like that. You end up paying significant tech costs over time, but that's kind of the bulk of it, and that's something that we burned over a two-year period, and we still have some of that capital, by the way. So that 700 that we raised is still serving us till today, but now we're closing a $3 million round. And that $3 million round will be used for growth. Bigger team, more marketing and brand awareness, and then also global expansion, because we'll talk about that if you want to.
Definitely.
But we realized we're the first in the world. We need to be also present outside.
And how? At what value is that $3 million?
That's a bit too confidential. Let's say it's at a value where it's a good return for the initial investors.
Okay.
Good returns.
Okay.
So far.
No problem at all. And in regards to the team, one of the most crucial things, elements while building a startup, and I've heard it from lots of podcasts, whether it's the Stephen Bartlett podcast or others, is building a very good, strong team. So how do you go about it? You need to have the right people at that. You need to be independent, right? You mentioned that earlier. You need to be independent. You need to you against the world. But at the end of the day, you cannot do it by yourself. You won't be able to challenge the world. You need to build that team around you. It will be your team against the world. You and your team against the world. So how do you go about that?
So you need to be independent until you surround yourself with the right people that you can trust. And that trust element is not straightforward and it's not easy. It's not like I hire a top talent from somewhere and okay, you've got my full trust. You have to prove it, right? You have to prove that you've got what it takes. You have to prove that you've got the dedication, the discipline, the commitment, and the passion for what we're doing. Otherwise, what am I trusting you for, right? But to answer your question, yes, hiring is probably the most difficult thing, and building the right team is probably the most difficult thing. As an early stage startup, where you're not in Silicon Valley raising $100 million to start building a team on a pre-seed level, you need to find the right balance in a matrix where you want top talent, but you also don't want to pay good salaries, or not good salaries, to pay exceptional salaries.
Yeah.
I can't compete with banks and law firms and consulting firms and, you know, top agencies. I just can't. These at least at this stage. Later on, maybe we can, but at this stage, we cannot. And we couldn't at that pre-seed stage. So we wanted to find that right balance of exceptional talent, but then also at a stage or at a salary range or compensation package that makes sense to us. And that's extremely difficult.
Mm.
We had high standards. We had really high standards. And we weren't able to afford to take that talent out of, you know, where they were.
Were you offering an ESOP?
Of course. There's always an ESOP. And there's always an active equity element. And something I've always said is, if you come in, you prove your worth, you can ask for the world. If someone is killing it with us and we love working with them, whatever they ask for, as long as it's reasonable, is doable.
Mm.
But the problem has been with our hiring is we tried to find that balance, and we haven't. We've had some good talent, and some of them are still with us, but a lot of them have changed, and it's just not fit for the culture that we're trying to build, not fit for what we're looking for. Sometimes the quality is poor. Sometimes the commitment is not there, not enough discipline, no real understanding for the product, no passion for what we're doing. And these are terrible components to have. So if you have someone in your team that has any of those, I think there is no point in having them in your team. And I think you'd be better served working harder, doing everything yourself, than relying on someone that won't get the job done in the best way possible. So hiring is tough, and finding the right people is difficult, and we're still figuring that out. We're a very lean team, and now once we close our round, we're looking to hire, and we're looking to hire different types of talent too. So we'll be exploring that. But yeah, the team part is a difficult one, and you need to get to a stage where the people that you're working with see things the way you do, to a certain extent, as in understand the potential of what you're doing, and believe in the vision the same way you believe in the vision. And also certain characters are just different. Some people are not built for this environment. They're built for a more corporate, relaxed job. They want a 9-to-5, and they get their salary at the end of the month, and you know there is no upside in ESOP or any of that, and they're fine with that. Some people would be very happy working weekdays and weekends, and even for less pay, for that higher potential or the equity or feeling part of the company or the challenge. And that's what we're looking for. Today, we might work with someone that we really like, but if they're just not the personality or the character that we need, then they won't be staying with us.
No, then that's part a bit of the ruthlessness that you mentioned. You need to find the right people, especially at an early stage.
Yeah.
You absolutely have to. If they're not willing to, you know, if they don't fit the culture naturally, you know, they need to fit the culture naturally. It's not something unnatural that has to come. It's difficult to stay with the team, right? Because again, you're a few people. All of you need to have that same heart, that same passion, that same drive, correct, to build something big. Yep. And if you're a CEO, right? So if you have all of that drive, and then next to you have that person who does not have it, it's gonna frustrate you more than it's gonna benefit you. Even if they're getting, like, let's say 10% of the job or whatever, they're removing some of the things off your plate, but it's still gonna frustrate you if they don't have at least the drive should be very close. Like,
yeah,
maybe some would argue that no employee, right, so should have the same amount of drive, but you are providing them ESOP, so they're relatively part of the company, right? But it needs to be somewhere there, somewhere. Maybe not the same, but at least somewhere there.
You're spot on. I think this applies to your team, but then also to the founding team. The founders have to have, you know, a similar drive, similar ambition, similar vision. And you know, I've been working with Imad, and it's been incredible. I think we actually are a very complementary founding team. But you always have to make sure that, generally speaking, the founders have to be very aligned. You can't have one founder who's, you know, out there putting in all the effort in the world, and another founder who's just not aligned. It won't work, and it would drain the other founder. And so we're blessed that, you know, Imad and myself are aligned. We've got our own set of skill sets, our own strengths and weaknesses, and we know that, and we complement each other. But I think anyone who wants to start a business, make sure that whoever you're starting is with, you're 100% certain of them, because that's the most important decision, your co-founder. And you cannot make mistakes there. But on the team, yeah, you need to get people. And I think a lot of it is character and personality. I don't care how old, how experienced. I think if someone has that drive and conviction and willingness to learn, there is nothing that you cannot learn in this world. You can be better than someone with 10 years of experience if you just have that hunger and desire. And that's what we're looking for, hunger and desire. If someone, again, wants to... Look, I'm not asking people to work 24/7 or on weekends. This is dedication and commitment, right? If someone wants to take us to the next level and wants this company to reach that global vision that we have, then they cannot be, you know, stopping work at 5 p.m. when we have more work, or, you know, when we need them on a weekend, they have to be there.
Of course not.
And I've been in that environment, which is investment banking. Yeah, we were paid. We were paid a lot, but we didn't have ESOPs. We didn't have equity in the business. We didn't have $1 billion potential where we're part of. So I see it in the same way, where
for sure,
if you want to be part of this journey, there is minimum effort, minimum requirement. And again, I love the team that we have now. I think we changed a bit, but the team that we have now is great. I think the guys are killing it, and hopefully they stay with us. But that's you know, you build a relationship, you love the people that you work with, but in the end of the day, if this changes or if someone is not delivering, ruthlessness is
correct,
is what you need to do.
And, you know, I understand what you're saying because of my experience with Maharat. You know, like, it started off with Bassem and Arman. I joined them at a very early stage, and I got ESOP as well. Also a salary, which wasn't the main thing, because as you said, when you join a startup, it's more about the vision, what you believe in. And I believed in the idea. I believe in the idea. I believe in the guys, right? And that's why I joined that journey. And it's not a typical corporate journey where you shut off at 5. No, sometimes I work late, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes I work on the weekends. But I used to get more pissed off when that happened in corporate, you know? But when it happens in Maharat, I don't get pissed off, because it's something, I got to get it done. And it's a part of me, it's a part of, like, it's more or less like a family type of vibe, right? Where a team, I would say a team more than a family. It's a strong team type of vibe with strong bonds, same vision, same mission. And that's what leads, I think, a startup to success, right? But if we shift a bit, right, topics and talk about the product and the adoption of your product, people adopting it, whether it's family offices or general public, are you doing any marketing efforts, right, to get it out there? At the end of the day, you need to create that awareness to people. So how are you tackling that? How are you, because you're offering an investment platform.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think in our region, we have Sarwa, that's an investment platform, right? A trading platform. They did a great job. They're doing a great job. So for Stride, what's the approach they're taking? Are they using any performance ad, using social media? Are you guys exclusively using email marketing? Are you using any other forms? So how would that go in your industry?
Raising brand awareness and educating people is probably one of the most difficult things, right? If you're building a new brand, how can you reach as many people as possible, and how can you reach the right people? But then also, how can you explain what you do and how you do it and what's the value add and why they should be part of it is a difficult journey and a complex formula. But in our case, we actually haven't done extensive marketing. We haven't spent a lot on marketing. We've tested and we're still testing. We boost an ad, we try some meta ads, we boost something on Instagram, we tried something on LinkedIn, we tested, but it's nothing that, we don't have a clear strategy for that yet, and that's part of the next step. But it's also not our preferred approach. We're not a Sarwa. Sarwa is, you know, a platform where you can go put $100 in a robo advisory or in public stocks. This is not what we are. We're a much more niche, much more exclusive, I would say, type of platform where, first of all, you're getting access to something that you cannot get access to anywhere in the world. Just like Sarwa, there's others, right? In our space, there is no one. The second thing is word of mouth has been how this whole thing grew. Waleed tells a friend, a friend tells a friend, a friend tells a friend, and that's how it grows, or how it grew, and how it's still growing today. it's word of mouth, and it's just building a reputation and building the brand, and people starting to know that, okay, this exists and we can do this and that. So no, it hasn't been social media. It hasn't been paid ads. Email marketing, we don't do email marketing. We do that to engage with our existing users, so not to acquire new users. So once you're in our funnel, or once you're in our user list or our investor base, yeah, you receive regular emails about the new opportunities, what's going on in the business of sports and stuff like that. But word of mouth has been how we grew. And a lot of our investors in the platform, so in Stride and through Stride, you know, are in consulting and banking in the region here, and they tell their friends, and they tell their friends tell their friends, and it grew. But what's interesting is that over the past 4 to 6 weeks, more than 50% of our users have been coming from the US and the UK. So there's something that we're doing right there. I'm not so sure about what that is yet, but we're getting a lot of traction from outside. And that also goes hand in hand with the globalization idea and the fact that we need to be present everywhere in the world. And we're working on that.
Yeah, that's definitely interesting. This, I think the States is definitely, you know, a market for you.
Yeah.
All these different, let's say, advanced countries are a market for you. The United States, maybe some countries in Europe, right?
What's interesting about the U.S., though, yeah, and we already know that, and we all know that, in the U.S., they're early adopters. They're happy to try. They're quick to try. They don't mind, you know, taking risks. They don't mind innovation. They don't mind the new ways of doing things, which is why, obviously, they're ahead in everything. Here, for you to convert someone from a traditional way of doing things to a new way of doing things, that could be a 2-year process, right? So you don't have that same level of adaptability yet. And I think the fact that we've built a product here that we're realizing works for the user base here makes it even better as a product for that market there, because you've nailed it for a target market that's a bit slower, that's a bit more behind in terms of, you know, the nature of doing things. And then you can implement that in a quick market, in a very rapid market. And again, I mentioned working on that, and it could be very soon where we're going to have our presence in the US.
Are you looking at Saudi football clubs?
We're looking at good investment opportunities. The problem with Saudi football clubs is that they all burn a lot of money. And today, the way the investment in sports works, you own equity, you invest, you own shares. But then if the club loses money, you have to foot the bill every year, right? Whoever owns the shares need to pay up the prorated loss. Mm. So if a club is losing 100 million and you own 10%, that's 10 million a year out of your pocket. Mm. So that's, we don't own shares, and you can just watch what's going on.
Okay, so that's a very good point. So you're looking also at strategic clubs as well. Because Watford is very strategic. They are not a club that just burns money.
They're a profitable club.
They're a profitable
club. Benfica is a highly profitable club.
So that's also smart, yeah, and investments, right? You're looking at stuff that would be also a good return for the investors themselves that you're bringing on. And that's where the level of trust starts kicking in, right?
We built a mandate. We built our preferred investment mandate, and that includes a club that's not burning cash. So
honestly, Hadi, the Dubai investment opportunity seems super attractive. I'm very much looking forward to see what it will be, and hopefully invest in it as well. Hadi, if anyone is watching us today, watching you, right, what and they're interested in this journey, what are some few words of wisdom that you can share that would help them, you know, kick off this entrepreneurship journey?
I would say take the risk and have full conviction in yourself and the idea, perseverance, discipline, make sure that whatever happens, you won't give up. And there is always a way. Genuinely, there is always a way. If you work hard enough and if you think hard enough, you'll come up with a solution. And don't be afraid to tap into your network, to ask for favors. If you launch a product, ask everyone around you for a favor to try the product out, to support them. If you're selling something, ask them to buy a subscription. Like, don't be afraid to tap into your circle, and don't be afraid to get feedback, because the most important thing, especially if you're building a customer-facing product, is customers' feedback. Don't be attached to anything, an idea, a name, a person, nothing. Be very lean, be very adaptable, and it's probably the most fulfilling thing you can do, at least in my opinion. I mean, we've been doing this for 2 years. No one knows how it'll go or what will happen in a few years. We might be the biggest global company. We might be struggling. No one knows. It's definitely been the most challenging, but the most fulfilling journey. I wake up every day, and when I go to sleep, genuinely, when I go to bed, I feel like I'm losing time. I wouldn't want to sleep. Sometimes I struggle because I feel I still want to do something else. And that feeling you wouldn't get in a corporate job, in my opinion. You wouldn't get in any other job. And that's been the differentiator. And if anyone has that conviction, I mentioned to you, it's about a personality and a character. If anyone feels they have that personality, that character, then go for it and you'll figure it along the way.
Beautiful words, man. And if you would give yourself, your 17-year-old self, one advice, very short advice, what would it be?
Take more risks. Try more things. I was thinking about this actually, and that's a very good point. What if at 17 I tried to start something? What if at 19 I tried to start something? What if at 21 I tried to start something? What if I just tried a bunch of different things? What if I went into random things and just did random things that excited me, that resonated with me? I just think our culture, where we come from, and that doesn't apply to anyone, at least for me, you go to school, at 18 you have to run to uni, do 3, 4, 5 years, finish your degree, get a job, start your job. So like until maybe 24, 25, till you get the chance to start thinking, what am I doing? Because everything else is rushed. And that's how it's been for us. What if at 18 and 19 you sit and reflect? What if you can try different things at an earlier stage? So I would just say to my 17-year-old self, take more risks and try more things, because we only live this life once, and there is no point in living it safely, in my opinion. This doesn't apply to everyone. It doesn't have to. I just want to take more risks and do more things, and I will keep doing that.
Man, beautiful stuff. And I wish you all the best with Stride. I mean, I'm rooting for you as a podcast host, as a friend, as a brother. And I can't wait to see where Stride will be in a few years, but I'm very confident it's gonna be up there.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. I hope so. And this has been fun. And we did not expect to to enjoy an hour conversation after speaking for an hour yesterday. But it's
anytime,
really good.
Anytime. And thank you all for watching. Don't forget to subscribe, like. And again, thank you, man, for joining us.
Thanks, Waleed.
Thank you.